From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Republican Cindy Hyde-Smith is heading back to Washington, having won her Senate race in Mississippi against the Democrat Mike Espy, a racially charged campaign in a state described as having the most racially divided electorate in the country. And today, Democrats in the House are meeting behind closed doors to elect their next leader. Will it be their former leader, Nancy Pelosi? Senators are being briefed by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who says degrading ties with Saudi Arabia over the murder of a journalist would be a mistake for national security. Oh, and the president is giving out interviews. He is not happy with his Fed chair or GM or that climate report. Let's bring in ABC Politics editor Rick Klein. Hi, Rick.
Hey, great to be with you.
So a lot going on, but talk about these interviews with the Washington Post, Politico, the president fuming with Fed chair Jerome Powell, his appointee, for the slow raise of interest rates. President saying he might or might not meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman at the upcoming G20 summit in Argentina. But he won't interfere in the Russia investigation and doesn't believe in climate change. He said one of the problems, a lot of people like myself, high levels of intelligence, we're not necessarily such believers. You look at our air and our water, right now it's record clean. What jumps out at you?
I think the through line here is that the president is frustrated by a couple of facts. One is forces outside of his control, whether that's the Fed chair or the Mueller investigation or some other world actors and world powers. We're seeing Trumpism tested both at home and abroad. And I think the economic indicators with the announcement from General Motors this week, with the Federal Reserve's decisions on interest rates, are maybe a little bit problematic, maybe a little troublesome. And I think the foreign policy indicators with the president set to go to the G20 later in the week are also problem signs. And I think the restiveness on Capitol Hill around his foreign policy, around domestic policy, it's all beginning to catch up with the president. And I think that that's coming through in the frustration that he's airing.
When he spoke about Saudi Arabia's crown prince again, who the CIA has assessed, ordered the assassination of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, he said the CIA was not did not confirm that, and that Mohammed said he didn't do it. It's being said that it's the media that is making this a pile-on against the administration, but Republicans are pushing the administration to do more. Here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell yesterday.
What obviously happened, as basically certified by the CIA, is completely abhorrent to everything the United States holds dear and stands for in the world. So some kind of response to that certainly would be in order.
And so where do you think this is going?
I think there's a growing frustration inside the Republican Party over the way that the president has handled the issue with Khashoggi. And I think it's going to come to a head in a vote as soon as today. Yemen is a war that the Saudis have been supporting for some time. And I think there's growing frustration about American involvement in that. And I think you're seeing a bipartisan effort around that. And I think ultimately a president who is standing pretty much alone on his denial about the Saudi involvement in this killing and his support for a Saudi regime that has less and less popularity, frankly, inside the Senate.
Yeah. Well, senators are also fighting over whether to include a measure to protect Special Counsel Robert Mueller in this must-pass spending bill. It has to pass to avert a partial government shutdown at the end of next week. Where do you think that goes?
I think the president is pushing any advantage he can, and he's using the headlines out at the border to try to press it. He's also talking about the possibility of an exit ramp on this and maybe finding some other money to do border wall funding. But he is being told by a lot of his advisors that this is the best moment to try to get that border wall. It's not going to happen when the Democrats take over the House. And he is even saying publicly he believes it's a winning political issue. So I think the combination of factors suggests that we are headed to some sort of a potential government shutdown next week. Democrats think they've got more sway with this than they have in the past. Republicans really don't want to see this happen, but they have a president who's pretty adamant on the point.
Yeah. What about Nancy Pelosi? Does she have the support finally to become the next speaker for the Democrats in the House? And by the way, if she does, what happens to the Democrats who very publicly fought that?
She almost certainly does have the votes to become the future speaker. No one is actually opposing her. The vote inside the House Democratic Caucus is just yes or no on Pelosi. There will be some no's. And I think she's conducted something of a political clinic in trying to minimize those no's and send the word to many of the would-be no's that isn't a productive strategy. But she is such a shrewd operator, and I feel like that Trump and what he's been doing the last couple of weeks has probably helped in his own way, maybe not the way he intended, in teeing this enough for her because the stability, the discipline that she showed in trying to pursue the speakership once again is really exactly what the Democrats need. And I think more are coming to that realization that, yes, there are generational challenges and there are ideological challenges for the Democrats, but Nancy Pelosi knows how to do this job, bottom line, and she will almost certainly be given the opportunity to do it again.
Okay, we're talking about all the fights going on and the funding that's being asked for. One is the fight over money for the border wall. The president says he wants $5 billion more, would be totally willing to risk a shutdown over it just in the few seconds we have. What happens here?
I think the funding is likely to be a compromise, but I wouldn't underestimate the president's willingness to go to a shutdown over this. He believes that this is the moment to press his advantage on this, and he thinks it's a political winner.
And there's already a mess at the border. Rick Klein, politics director at ABC News. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, Rick mentioned the Fed chair and President Trump's anger with the Fed chair. Well, today he said that the current interest rate level is just below neutral. When he said that, the Dow surged hundreds of points. So we will keep watching that story. Well, in many areas of this country, rural areas, public schools are shrinking or even closing. Many districts have consolidated with neighboring towns to pool resources, but others are taking a different approach. They're charging tuition. David DeRoche of Connecticut Public Radio has the story.
Small classroom sizes and the intimate setting that the school is able to give to the children has created the perfect teaching environment.
What you just heard is a promotional video made by the town of Bridgewater, Connecticut, population 1,600. It's about 10 minutes away from the nearest city in the western part of the state. The town made the video to get people to move there. They also spent about $6,000 to send glossy 8-page pamphlets to 5,000 homes in surrounding towns. This is all happening because enrollment at Burnham, the only elementary school in Bridgewater, has been dropping for years. At one point, there were only 3 kids in an entire grade there. Teresa DeBrito runs the district's curriculum department.
What are we really offering kids if there's only 3 of them in a classroom and they stay together for 6 years?
So last year, Burnham combined its 6 grades into essentially 2 classrooms. Then the marketing began.
I was looking for something different, but I didn't think I could afford it.
Parent Reese Gordon was visiting a friend who had received a pamphlet in the mail advertising the school.
A Montessori-type model would be more of my ideal. And then she was like, this might be just for you. And I was like, yes, this is just for me.
The Gordons are one of 10 families that spent at least $2,500 to send their kids to Burnham last year. It's one of the few public schools in the country tackling enrollment problems by charging tuition, says Alan Pratt of the National Rural Education Association.
Actively marketing or going after, you know, it's generally not that way across the U.S. It may be in pockets, but usually in your rural, remote areas, there's not a lot of choices out there.
Rural schools are having to become increasingly creative to stay viable. Some are partnering with nearby bigger towns to provide vocational training. And others are offering more online classes, and some, like Burnham, are looking at what's called multi-aged groupings. But among the biggest struggles for rural schools, teacher shortages, Pratt says. To compensate, a lot of schools in the bigger states have gone to a 4-day school week.
They try to attract teachers that way because it's one day less a week. They also provide more support and training for teachers on that 5th day when they do that.
It's even harder to find qualified substitutes.
It's very difficult. Very, very difficult.
Frank Ola is superintendent of Hampton Schools in eastern Connecticut.
As soon as you go a long-term sub, they have to be certified. And if it's a long-term sub in art, you have to try to find a person who's certified in art first. If you can't, then you have to find somebody who's just certified. So it's very difficult.
Hampton, population 1,800, has the same problems as Bridgewater, but the towns don't have the same resources. Half of Hampton's budget comes from state dollars. Bridgewater residents are more affluent, so they get less money from the state. At the same time, Hampton residents want their small school to stay open, Ola says. Voters have rejected efforts to consolidate.
If I were a business person, okay, and I looked at this, I'd say it's very inefficient. I have too many open classrooms. There are too many things here that are expensive. If we consolidated, now this school is closed. And now all of a sudden, I think the people of Hampton will say, but that's not our school anymore. There's something about this local concept that the parents are willing to pay for.
But some classrooms are empty. Others have only a handful of students. And outside money from the state and federal governments is helping to keep the school open. School board chairman Rose Bisson says they're trying to group different grades together, but change is difficult.
I don't know what the future will be. It might be we have to close down. It might not be. You know, maybe somebody will build a factory and all sorts of people will move in or something. I guess we just don't know. But we know we need to adjust. We need to change.
Hundreds of schools close down across the country every year, and many are in rural areas. But not all hope is lost. Multi-age grouping and a hefty marketing budget has been promising, at least in tiny Bridgewater, Connecticut. For the first time in at least a decade, there was a bump in enrollment last year at Burnham Elementary School. They gained 2 students. For Here and Now, I'm David Roche in Hartford.
Now that the campfire in Northern California is totally contained, more people are able to return to the site of their homes. Officials say the fire killed at least 85 people and destroyed more than 14,000 residences. Polly Stryker of KQED went back to Paradise with one couple to see their burned property for the first time.
David Herman and Dana Silvera had packed their RV for a vacation. It was sitting in their driveway, ready to go when they got off work on November 8th. And then, instead of a vacation, it all burned, and they ended up homeless.
That's our mailbox. It is standing. Remember how rickety you said it was, and we need a new one?
Cindy's house is gone.
Yes.
Well, it's real rickety right now.
So there it is, right there.
About 2 weeks later, we drive back into Paradise, a blackened landscape of twisted metal and downed power lines.
There's his Dodge right there with the X on it, and there's our trailer.
It's a lot more final when you look at it. That's front windows. Yeah, this is the front two bedrooms, master bedroom, living room. Really, the only thing that survived is the rain gutter.
David is a UPS driver, and Dane is a health insurance agent. They lived in a house David renovated himself. It had a sweeping view of a valley with trees. Now it's all charred. The Yamaha ATV, the refrigerator, blackened silverware, even the fire extinguisher.
Your bed frame's still here.
Take a picture of it. I'm going to meet with the insurance adjuster.
It's bizarre what
this
didn't burn.
What is that?
It's a Walmart bowl. It's a Walmart bowl.
The dishes that I gave him such a hard time about that I never wanted to see again made it. Oh, look at all that.
Glass is scattered, windows blown out by the crucible of the fire. Nails lie neatly on the ground, all that's left of the wood they once kept together.
There they are.
Dana finds her junior high photos in a twisted tin box.
That was my hope, was that my junior high pictures would make it, because they were in that metal box. There they are, just complete ash. This is the only thing left of my pictures.
They take in the loss. It's overwhelming.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. This is unreal. Unreal. Everything we worked for.
It's unreal, and it's absurd. They point to their neighbor's untouched house next door. Dana says she feels bad for them because she knows they feel bad. It all drives home how indiscriminate the fire was. Planning didn't help this couple.
See, my whole yard is rock. I was prepared for a low grass fire. This tree fire didn't stand a chance.
David and Dana had insurance, so they'll get a chance to rebuild, if they want to.
KQED's Polly Stryker in Paradise. Among those taking center stage at next month's Nobel Prize ceremony in Sweden are 2 female scientists who have made history. This year's honorees include Canadian Donna Strickland, only the 3rd woman ever to win the Nobel Prize in physics, and American Frances Arnold, who was the 5th woman in history to win the Nobel in chemistry. She's a professor at Caltech and joins us now from Pasadena. Frances Arnold, welcome to Here and Now, and congratulations.
Thank you.
So you've had a little bit of time now to let this Nobel win sink in. How are you feeling as you get closer to the prize ceremony?
Oh, I'm nervous and overwhelmed. I was hoping that things would calm down, but they've only gotten worse.
How surprised were you when you found out that you won?
I was sound asleep, so that tells you how much I was expecting it. And of course, I was tremendously surprised, terrified, and overwhelmed and thrilled all at the same time.
Well, tell us about what you won for. They awarded you and two others for your work harnessing the power of evolution. What does that mean?
Well, if you look at the biological world and all the amazing chemistry biology does, it comes about through this one simple design process called evolution. Everything in the biological world is a product of this 4 billion years of evolutionary work. I'm interested in using evolution to move forward into the future, to get biology to do a lot of new chemistry for us.
What does that mean? How would you use that?
Well, people have been using evolution for thousands of years. Breed everything from corn to carrier pigeons, lab rats, racehorses, hairless cats. Why not do it with molecules? We take the DNA that encodes biological molecules that are useful to human beings, and we breed those molecules in the test tube, just like we've been doing for animals and plants.
What first got you interested in this?
Oh, I got interested in chemistry as a graduate student. My first course, where I looked at the structure of an enzyme, I was blown away by the beauty and complexity of just the simplest biological things. I had a degree in aerospace engineering and always thought I would engineer the most complicated things on the planet. Well, I discovered those. It's called biology.
Hmm. But there was a time in your life that you were doing completely different things. You were a cab driver at one point.
Early on, yes. You made more money as a cab driver than working in a pizza parlor.
And you were a waitress, too.
I was.
And did you ever think during that you would be winning a Nobel Prize at some point in your life?
No, I never thought I'd be winning a Nobel Prize. Mm-hmm. It's a very rare event. And it's a nice thing, but not something I expected.
What does it mean to you to be a woman winning this prize, succeeding in your field the way that you are? There are not very many women who have won Nobel Prizes so far.
Well, that's right. And I think the so far that you say is the most important point. I was one of the first women in engineering at my undergraduate institution at Princeton. I was one of the very first women hired even at Caltech as a professor. So in that sense, there weren't very many women who could compete. That's changed completely. I've been at Caltech for 30 years now, and I've seen brilliant women come up through the ranks doing amazing chemistry, physics, biology. My prediction is we'll see a steady stream of those winning Nobel Prizes in the future.
Why do you say that?
Because they're brilliant. Their work is brilliant. Also, the Nobel Committee has made a conscious effort to get more nominations, right? You don't get a Nobel Prize unless someone takes the time and trouble to nominate you. And it's the committee has taken on that task to make sure that women at least get nominated. Then they can be considered. And when you consider women, you'll see their chemistry is beautiful.
Do you feel a responsibility yourself to encourage other women to excel in science?
I feel a responsibility to encourage everyone to excel in science. Science is so important for the future of our country and the future of the world. Otherwise, how will we be able to feed 10 billion people and live sustainably? So we need all of the minds, and women are half of our population. It'd be crazy not to encourage women, but I'm talking about everyone. Everyone needs a scientific background to be an educated person, and even better, they might become scientists themselves.
Has any of your work as a scientist changed since President Trump came into office? Many people look at his administration and say he's anti-science.
I'm disappointed that the White House has not shown much interest in science, and I'm hoping that that will change.
But for you personally, it hasn't made much of a difference?
Not really.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you just about your personal story a little bit. You have overcome a lot in your life. You're a breast cancer survivor. You lost your first husband to cancer. Another partner of yours died by suicide, your son, William, died in an accident in 2016. Of course, our condolences to you for all that you've been through. I just wonder how this moment in your life, what it means to you, given all that you've been through already.
I miss the people that I love and who are gone. I miss my father. I miss my partners. I dearly miss my son. But on the other hand, everyone has to go through these things. Life is not a piece of cake, and it certainly is not for many of the people I know. I'm very grateful, actually, that these people were in my life, and I'm very grateful for the people who are still in my life. And that's the way that I move forward, is I look at all the wonderful things I have rather than spend my time fretting about what I don't.
Gotta appreciate the good things.
I think that's, maybe I was born that way, or maybe I've cultivated it, but it happens to work.
And how have you managed the process of healing in your life while also clearly maintaining a dedication to your work? Or do you have any advice to people who have to overcome obstacles themselves while remaining professionally excellent?
Rest on your friends. We all need friends, and friends are there to hold you up when nothing else can. And I am very lucky to have a wonderful institution I work for. Caltech is a place where I have many friends, and I have many friends outside of Caltech who've been there for me.
So, Frances Arnold, after you pick up this Nobel Prize later this year, what's your next plan?
I'm only thinking up until December. It's hard to make plans when I'm preparing a retinue of 50 people. I have a lot of friends who are coming to Stockholm with me, and we're going to have an epic party.
An epic
then
party.
Then I'll think about the future. An epic party, yes.
That's Frances Arnold, who is one of the winners of this year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry. She is the fifth woman in history to get to this point. Frances Arnold, thank you so much for your time, and congratulations again.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
And we want to check in now in Hoover, Alabama, where there have been several days of protests of the police shooting death of E.J. Bradford, the young black man shot by a police officer responding to a shooting Thanksgiving night at the River Chase Galleria Mall south of Birmingham. E.J. was holding a gun. His father says he was licensed to carry. Witnesses say he was waving people away from the shooting, but police thought he was the shooter and later had to retract that. The real gunman has not been found. Gigi Duban and is news director at WBHM in Birmingham. And Gigi, police said the gun heightened the sense of threat to the police officer. But do we know if he told EJ to drop the gun?
We don't. And, you know, according to Emantic Bradford Jr.'s family, or EJ as he's called, the police officer that night never gave him any verbal commands before he shot EJ Bradford.
Well, aren't they calling for police cameras? And wouldn't there be video in the mall?
Sure. The family is calling for the release of all video from that night. Mm-hmm. That would include surveillance video from the mall, witness videos that people might have submitted or the police might have gotten, and police body cameras. But the police to this point have not released any of that video footage. And the investigation is with the state's top law enforcement, the Alabama Law Enforcement Agency.
And do we understand as well, according to EJ's mother, April Pipkins, the police did not contact her about this shooting death. And still as of Monday, I think reports were that they had not spoken to her.
That's right. Both EJ Bradford's mother and his father say they never received a call from police notifying them that their son had been shot and killed. Now, on Monday morning, the Hoover Police Department and the city issued a joint statement that said that they extend their sympathy to the victims that night, everybody who was affected by the shooting, including E.J. Bradford's family, and they vowed transparency in the investigation.
Well, there have been protesters outside the home of Hoover's mayor, Frank Brocato, outside the Hoover Police Department. They are saying things like, you know, if we don't have justice, you don't have sleep. But what else do they want? What are they demanding?
Well, they want answers more than anything. They want to know what happened that night. To this point, the identity of the police officer who shot and killed E.J. Bradford has not been released. That police officer has been placed on administrative leave, but we don't know who that person is.
Well, look, earlier this month, police killed a black security guard holding down a shooting suspect at a bar in Robbins, Illinois. And now you have someone the police are saying was not a shooter. Who may have been using his gun to try to defend against a shooting. What are people there saying about the thinking that, you know, it's good guys with guns that are needed to take down bad guys with guns? Here we have possibly two shot and killed.
There are many people here in the black community, especially, who are angry and fearful. It just sort of underscores this notion that you can't be a good guy with a gun if you're black. That is what folks here have been saying who are frustrated by the lack of transparency and with just how quickly police came out to say that they had shot and killed the shooter at the mall that night. And they were pretty certain about that. And then to backpedal later and say that he probably wasn't the shooter and the real shooter is still at large was indicative to many in the community that the police weren't being very honest.
That's WBHM News Director Gigi Duban in Birmingham, Alabama. Gigi, thank you.
You're welcome.
General Motors stock fell again this morning after a nosedive yesterday following a tweet from President Trump. He slammed the company for its plans to cut 14,000 jobs and shut down 5 plants in North America. But GM's decision comes amid larger industry trends. Nathan Bomey covers the auto industry for USA Today and joins us from Los Angeles, where the LA Auto Show is getting underway. Nathan, GM is dumping the Chevy Cruze, the Impala, the Volt. They're moving away from sedans. As gas prices have stayed relatively low, what's going on?
Well, I think when you look at the last several years, gas prices have not only been low, they've been involatile in the sense that they've stayed below $3. And so people believe that they'll stay there for a long time. And that has led to this market shift toward larger vehicle sales. And it's not just that. It's also fuel economy improvements for SUVs and crossover vehicles, such that the difference now between an SUV and a midsize car is not as wide as it used to be. So people who have had a preference for a larger vehicle are shifting toward those bigger cars.
And when you look at the sales numbers, what does it look like? Is it really that nobody's buying small cars, or is it just a trend line that's starting to look like that's what it's going to be in the future?
It's very ugly. This is not a good situation for passenger cars. You know, Fiat Chrysler has already eliminated most of its small vehicles, small cars, that is. Ford Motor Company recently announced that it will also get out of the small car business for the most part, but getting rid of the Fusion and other vehicles. And now General Motors' decision to eliminate most of its small cars, you know, including the Chevy Volt and the Chevy Cruze, is an indicator of how poorly these vehicles are selling. And now even the Japanese automakers that have long been known for their smaller cars are struggling to sell them as well.
And what about when it comes to fuel efficiency? I mean, are we focusing on the wrong thing by focusing on the size of the car? Are these bigger cars just as fuel efficient as the small cars were 10 years ago?
I do think that the paradigm has changed. There certainly are still gas guzzlers out there today, but they're not dominating the market like they used to, because ultimately a lot of these so-called SUVs are really just crossovers. And what is a crossover? It's just essentially a car that sits up a little bit higher. So if you only give up a few miles per gallon if you go up to a crossover or an SUV, a lot of people are willing to take that risk with gas prices being still relatively low.
So while we're looking at this and what happened this week, you know, you focus on how consumer trends are changing, what people are buying, what they're not buying. But one of the conversations that's been going on in the background for the last couple of years is that we're moving to a totally different playing field when it comes to cars, that people are going to be, you know, members of a subscription service where they don't really own their car. They just use it sometimes, or they have a self-driving car, or they're just going to Uber everywhere. So has the landscape changed so much, or is it changing so much that it really isn't clear what these companies are going to need to do in the future?
I think there's a recognition that the industry is definitely headed toward dramatic change. when you talk to General Motors, you know, and CEO Mary Barra realizes this is coming and says we can't be heavily invested or overinvested in old gasoline engine vehicles that can't drive themselves because we can't afford to get stuck with those types of capital investments if this is where the market is heading. The only question is, are they too soon? And what if the market ends up shifting back toward passenger cars and all they have is SUVs? So there's a lot of unknowns, but I think what Mary Barra is doing is realizing she doesn't want to make the mistakes that her predecessors made. Mm-hmm. The GM failed to change over so many times in the past, and that led to bankruptcy. She's trying to change, and whether it's good changes is up for debate, but I think that she doesn't want to stay still.
Why can't they build the cars of the future in the factories where they've built the cars of the present?
It's a good question. I think that that's probably going to be a source of criticism. Why not retool some of these factories? I think for starters, it can be very expensive to basically rehab a old style factory and then make the new vehicles. And the other element here is I think they're bracing for probably lower sales in the coming years. The auto industry had record sales in 2015 and then record again in 2016. Cooled off a little bit last year and this year, but still at very healthy levels. And so, and those are probably not going to be there forever. And I think they want to brace for the fact that ultimately this is likely going to take a little bit of a step back.
Why do Americans still want to drive such large vehicles, even if they're fuel efficient? Why do they want to drive such big cars?
It's such a good question. You know, I wrote a story just recently about this mid-size pickup boom. You know, we all know that full-size pickup trucks are very popular in America, the F-Series and the Silverado, but now mid-size trucks, just a little bit smaller, are also popular. And at the Los Angeles Auto Show here this week, we're expecting Fiat Chrysler to introduce the Jeep Gladiator, which is essentially the Jeep Wrangler made into a pickup truck. So that's a mid-size pickup. I mean, we're talking about some of these vehicles that are really pretty significant. I think that it's a cultural thing, you know, and I think Americans just love big things. But if you look at the transition that's happening, it's really happening across the board. It's Toyota. It's Honda. Toyota still makes the Toyota Camry, but it's not the most popular Toyota anymore. Believe it or not, nearly two-thirds of Toyotas now are SUVs, pickups, or crossovers. And so this is a transition that is sparing nobody.
Nathan Bomey, business reporter with USA Today, joining us from Los Angeles, where the LA Auto Show is going on. Nathan, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, in Alaska, autumn is one of two times a year when indigenous Inupiat hunters engage in the generations-old tradition of hunting the bowhead whale. They're still allowed by law to do it. And this fall's hunt has brought both excitement and sorrow to the community. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig reports.
It's a few days after the last whale has been brought on shore in Utqiagvik, and Ross and Justina Wilhelm's house is crowded with about 20 friends and relatives who've been working many long hours to get everything ready for the event that's about to take place. They're setting out donuts and pineapple cake and arranging plates of cooked whale meat and blubber for guests. Nearby, bags are being filled with different parts of the whale, including cuts of raw blubber and skin called muktuk, for people to take home.
Okay, and then if the muktuk is small, you guys need to put two, please.
Two muktuk if it's small.
Ross Wilhelm is a whaling captain, and his crew, with help from others, brought in the final whale of the season. His wife, Justina, is responsible for organizing tonight's cruise serving, an event where anyone in the community can come get a portion of the whale.
So we'll go ahead and let's make our circle bigger so we can include everybody.
When everything is ready, the group joins hands and prays. Ross's mother, Laku Kanungnana, says the prayer in Inupiaq, expressing gratitude for the whale they're about to serve. The prayer is broadcast over a local radio channel, along with the family's house number and an announcement that they're ready for people to come over for food. Soon, there's a steady stream of people revolving through the house, yelling congratulations and trading hugs in the Wilhelm's living room.
Hi, how are you?
Some stay and eat and chat. Others say their hellos and then grab to-go bags of whale to bring home. Ross Wilhelm spends the evening shaking hands and greeting visitors.
It's just what puts us together is the whale, the bowhead whale. Just gets us all together. Hi, John.
Thanks for coming here. Yes.
Wilhelm says there was additional excitement to fall whaling this year. That's because Alaska's subsistence hunters won some key changes to the bowhead whale quota set by the International Whaling Commission. But this year, the community also suffered a profound loss. Captain Roxy Oyaguk Jr., and crew member Ron Kinnearick were killed in a whaling accident off the coast of Utqiagvik when their boat capsized while towing a whale to shore. In conversations around town, it's clear there's still a lot of pain related to the accident. It's also an important reminder of something that whalers already know well, that whaling is dangerous. Wilhelm says he was shaken by what happened.
I'd look make myself look bad if I said it doesn't scare me, you know, because I'd be stupid if I didn't say that, you know, like of course it does.
Despite what happened this season and a close call he himself had in the past, Wilhelm isn't deterred from the hunt. He says sometimes things happen that are outside your control, but the only thing you can do is renew your vigilance when it comes to basic safety.
You know, steer left, steer right, stay straight, you know, watch the stern, watch the bow.
Crawford Putkatuk is another whaling captain. He says that many in the community are still mourning the loss of the two men, but the overarching dedication to continuing the tradition of whaling remains strong.
But for the most part, our people are able to rebound and continue our life, our culture, and knowing that Roxy and Ron would have it no other way. They would want us to continue our culture.
Fall whaling concluded in Utqiagvik with hunters bringing in a total of 19 whales, the full number of whales permitted by their quota. For Here and Now, I'm Ravenna Koenig, reporting from Utqiagvik, Alaska.
Now that we're full swing into holiday season, cinnamon is king or queen, not sure. Cookies, cakes, those smelly sticks you put in boiling water to make it smell like you're cooking, even if you're not. But Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunn says there's much more to the spice. She's brought some dishes to prove it, including a plate of cinnamon. Hi, Kathy.
Hello there.
So, Jeremy, I know you also, every fall, harvest the cinnamon that you grow in your garden.
Yes, yes. Such a DIYer.
I have a side gig as a cinnamon harvester.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about Boston cinnamon.
Where does cinnamon come from? What is it?
Well, it is the spice from the inner bark of the cinnamon tree, and it grows primarily in southern China, southern India, Sri Lanka, and there are so many different types, despite the fact that your grocery store probably only sells one variety.
Well, you've got a plate in front of us that looks like it's going to be a blind taste test, but we can see that there are three different kinds of cinnamon on this plate. What are the different kinds?
Right, as well as a cinnamon stick. So let's start with the one to the left. This is a Sri Lankan cinnamon, also called Ceylon. It is one of the more expensive types of cinnamon. It is processed by hand, and it has a mild, delicate, subtle cinnamon flavor. It's particularly prized, and you can see that it's a tan brown color as opposed to the more reddish colors of the other varieties. Then something you can find if you search in many stores.
You can't find the Sri Lankan?
You can find it. You need to go to specialty spice stores or go online. Vietnamese cinnamon is much sweeter, and it's spicier. It is terrific for everyday cooking. It's worth seeking out. It's highly fragrant. And I just love it. And then on the right, just for comparison, is kind of the generic supermarket cinnamon that's never identified by country.
Not bad, though.
It's not bad. But compared to the Vietnamese and the Sri Lankan, it's a different thing. And then there's the cinnamon stick. So this is what's shaved off of the trees. Inner layers of bark are dried in the sun, and then they're rolled together by hand into what's called long quills. And then they're grated and cut. So it's pretty cool, the whole process of getting cinnamon. One of the most interesting things I learned was from a new book called Spice by Dr. Stuart Ferriman. And he said that cinnamon does not in itself taste sweet, but rather it enhances the perception of sweetness in other ingredients, which is a very interesting concept that a spice would not be sweet, but that you perceive it as sweetness. And it's perfect for sweet and savory. And let's start with the savory.
Oh, sure.
Okay, we've got I've got lamb in front of me.
You have lamb, and Robin has chicken. This is we aim to keep all our children happy here. Okay, Robin doesn't eat lamb, so I did it with chicken, but you can do either. These are braised lamb shanks, or in Robin's case, chicken thighs. The cinnamon is used, we use a cinnamon stick with chicken stock and red wine. I used fresh ginger and ground cumin. And then in a Moroccan flavors, there's pitted green olives and orange rind in there. And it cooks very slowly. And the cinnamon does add a sweetness, but it also is slightly spicy, right?
Mm. Yeah, delicious.
And I serve that on Israeli couscous. You could also use it on regular couscous or right. Great make-ahead dish for these kind of raw, early, almost winter days.
By the way, I assume you would never actually... There's a cinnamon stick in here.
Yes, you do not
you
eat the cinnamon
eat the
stick.
Cinnamon stick.
Although you can suck on it because there's a whole lot of flavor
well, you
still
you see
there.
Them in like drinks. They're like
yeah, hot cocoa,
yeah, right, exactly.
Right. Mexican hot chocolate. People use it as a straw, which is kind of clever and expensive.
Okay.
so then, of course, you know, the obvious things with cinnamon are sweet dishes. You think of Christmas cookies. You think of cinnamon rolls. But it's also used in bolognese sauce for pasta. It's also used in Indian dishes like chicken biryani. It's used in all kinds of sweet and savory. But I wanted to try a rice pudding because that is a classic winter comfort food. Mm-hmm. But what I did here was that I used the cinnamon in three different ways. I buried a cinnamon stick in the rice when I was cooking it. Mm. So it flavored the water that the rice was cooking it. Then I simmered some milk and cream and put the other half of the cinnamon stick in there along with some ground cinnamon. Then I cooked the cooked rice into this creamy mixture. Then I mixed cinnamon and sugar and kind of bruleed it on top, just put it under the broiler. So you really taste the cinnamon in many different levels, I hope.
I have to say, I'm not the biggest fan of rice pudding, but this one is really good.
All
right. You know,
yeah, the cinnamon makes a huge difference.
And there's also sun-dried cranberries in there and raisins. And you know, I'm not that big a fan of rice pudding either. So I really wanted to challenge myself because it seemed like such an obvious thing to do with cinnamon. And again, you try to use the best variety, the best quality cinnamon you can, and you'll get way more flavor. And you'll use a whole lot less because it's so full of flavor.
It's so good. By the way, I just tweeted out a picture so you can see the way the cinnamon that you've brought in, they look different.
They absolutely look different. Their colors. I also brought in a smoked cinnamon that we'll have a link to that this incredible spice chef in New York City is making so that you can add smokiness to stews. And I wanted to just say really quickly that buy it in small quantities. Don't keep it for more than 6 months and always stored in a cool, dark spot.
Here and now, resident chef Kathy Gunst, the original Spice Girl.
Spice.
We've got all the recipes at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.